KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
It's time for the Fish Report here on KSDP. We've got harvest numbers for the Alaska Peninsula, as well as an announcement from Chignik, some harvest numbers for Chignik and Bristol Bay, as well as an update from Kodiak. So let's get started right now with the harvest summary for the Alaska Peninsula for June 22nd, 2025. Yesterday, across the whole region, 47,000 sockeye were delivered for a grand total now of 455,000. 7,000 pink salmon were delivered for a total of 69,000, and 6,000 chum for a total of 102,000 to date. Going at the districts, Dolgoy Island area was having their first deliveries yesterday for a total of 400 sockeye. The Shumigan Islands had 7,000 sockeye delivered yesterday. They're now at 76,000. 2,000 pinks were added to the total for a total of just under 20,000, and 6,000 chum for a total of 27,000 to date. For South Unimak, 11,000 sockeye delivered there. They're at 273,000 to date, 5,000 pinks for a total of 50,000 to date, and 1,000 chum in South Unimak for a total of 75,000 chum to date. Moving over to the North Peninsula, the Northwestern District had continued fishing for a total of 8,000 sockeye delivered yesterday. They're at 14,000 to date, 7,000 sockeye in Nelson Lagoon for a total of 30,000, and Port Muller to Outer Port Hyden with 25,000 sockeye delivered. They're at 60,000 to date. For the Chignik announcements and the escapement across the peninsula, right now they have announced that Chignik escapement is at the midpoint for where they would like to be. If they are having the next scheduled opener for tomorrow, Tuesday, June the 24th at 2 p.m., and it will extend for 48 hours. They're projecting that if escapement continues to be 13,000 fish a day, that they will extend this opening past that point. Moving on down now to the Alaska Peninsula Weir Report for escapement. Yesterday, 17,000 sockeye went up to Chignik Weir for a total of 158,000. In 2017, they were at 196,000, and in 2016, they're at 200,000, so still catching up with those years. Nelson River is continuing its tremendous march forward with 7,300 sockeye up the Nelson River. They're at 69,000 to date, which again is somewhere around six times as much as any year in the last 10. 1,900 at the Bear River for a total of 13,000, putting that at the midpoint. Illinois River had 280, they're at 15,000. And more fish up the Orzinski Weir, 172 sockeye up Orzinski yesterday, they're at 627, and that is more than twice as much as any year in the last 10. We have some harvest reports for Kodiak. Yesterday, they had 20,000 sockeye delivered for a total of 58,000. For chum salmon, 44,000, making it a 2-to-1 ratio for chum on a delivery yesterday for a total of 118,000 chum to date. Looking at the Chignik harvest report, there was no new numbers delivered yesterday for the Chignik harvest report. It is going to be confidential, so they'll probably start doing their weekly reports there. For the Bristol Bay management area, 310,000 sockeye were delivered yesterday, their largest delivery of the year so far, for a total now of 710,000 sockeye to date. Looking at the districts, no new numbers at the Ugashik. Egigik had 47,000 sockeye delivered for a total of 230 to date. Nothing new at Naknek. Nushagik with 263,000. They're now at 315,000 to date. And that's pretty much the first deliveries we've seen at Nushagik so far this year, but they're starting to come up big. Togiak, nothing new there. They're still at 1,700 sockeye to date. That will do it for the Fish Report here on KSDP. Stay tuned for more great programming coming up right now on KSDP.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Despite the U.S. Supreme Court refusing to hear arguments last month from Apache Stronghold, the nonprofit is trying to revive its religious freedom case over Oak Flat in Arizona. As KJZZ's Gabriel Piet-Tarasio reports, the group's asking the High Court to reconsider.
I bet you the courts don't change their mind in 0.001% of the time.
Bob Miller's Eastern Shawnee and with ASU's Indian Legal Clinic. He's been following the saga to protect Oak Flat from copper mining. The nation's high court allows parties to reappeal a denied petition within 25 days. But Miller says asking the nine justices to reconsider will almost certainly not alter the outcome.
I cannot conceive of the Supreme Court changing its mind.
Conservative Justices Neil Gorsuch and Clarence Thomas argued in a dissent that not hearing Apache Stronghold's case was a grievous mistake, threatening to reverberate for generations. In a statement, Resolution Copper says the company appreciates the court's attention to this case, which had been reviewed over a dozen times. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Although Alaska is the land of 100,000 glaciers, only 700 of them have names. Very few of those are indigenous, but it's important for the writer of the new book called The Alaska Glacier Dictionary to include them. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, it's more than a reference book, but full of stories.
Naomi Clouda says her Glacier Dictionary is for travelers and armchair adventurers alike, to give them quick access to a glacier's vital stats and nuggets of history, some that have been erased from recent memory.
There are some really beautiful Alaska Native designations on glaciers. They'll be very descriptive. So it was really important to me to go ahead and get the indigenous names wherever I could find them.
Like Kidazkuni, the Dena'ina name for a glacier on Mount Spur.
And it means one that is burning inside. Now, picture this glacier is on Mount Spur. So in local memory, in indigenous memory, they would have known about the times that Mount Spur had erupted.
Clouda says the names of Alaska glaciers also tell the story of colonialism. When geologists from the U.S. Geological Survey mapped and named glaciers, they often supplanted indigenous names or failed to acknowledge the contributions of Alaska Natives, like the Athabascan hunting party led by Chief Sesui, who came to the rescue of some starving, nearly frozen U.S. Army explorers after a bear raided their cache in 1899. They took the men to their village, fed and clothed them for several months, and when the weather improved, guided them to safety. But it was the leader of that expedition, Lieutenant Joseph Heron, who was remembered with the name Heron Glacier, not Chief Sesui.
Every glacier has a story, and no two are alike.
That's why Clouda says when it comes to the indigenous history, the name of the glacier is literally the tip of the iceberg. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Cherokee Nation bike riders returned to the capital city of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma on Friday after finishing a 950-mile journey. This year's ride marked the Remember the Removal bike ride's 41-year anniversary. Riders followed the northern route of the Trail of Tears, honoring Cherokee ancestors who were forced to march it in the late 1830s. The journey began in Georgia and ended in Tahlequah. 12 cyclists from the Cherokee Nation took part in the ride over 3 weeks. Last week, U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. swore in Mark Cruz, a senior advisor to the Secretary for Indian Health. In a video on social media, Kennedy said the appointment is important for decision-making in the health department for Native Americans. Cruz is a citizen of the Klamath tribes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian Country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com. Support by Arctic Encounter 2025 in Anchorage, Alaska. Convening voices from the Arctic and beyond with high-level panels, networking, the Far North Fashion Show, and more. Registration at arcticencounter.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
We've seen much more fire in recent years, especially the frequency of those big seasons.
Wildfires burn homes and prompt evacuation notices for interior residents. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 23rd. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, lawmakers hear about the conditions of ICE detainees in Anchorage.
But it's our duty as a committee to understand why these people are here, what we are doing with them, and what financial liabilities we Alaskans may be responsible for.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Wildfire activity has exploded across interior Alaska amid widespread red flag warnings and the state's first ever heat advisory. The fires intermittently closed major highways over the weekend and led to the evacuations of hundreds of people around Fairbanks, Healy, and Tok. Shelby Herbert with the Alaska Desk has more.
Heather McGroarty lives 5 miles north of the Bear Creek fire near Healy. She and her husband knew they had to act this weekend when they saw the fire had crested a nearby ridge.
We had to start getting everything ready. We have 3 big, large pools that we had to put up, fill up, put sprinklers out, and start moving stuff around the yard to be able to keep it safe.
McGroarty evacuated Saturday with her 2 daughters, ages 8 and 12. She says her husband stayed to clear their 40-acre property and cut trees.
He is protecting our home. That is our home. We don't really live anywhere else. We're there all year round, whether we have 10 feet of snow or the fire. We try not to leave.
McGroarty and her family are among hundreds of interior Alaskans asked to evacuate their homes as lightning and human-caused fires flare. Some homes and other structures have burned, but it's not clear yet how many. Beth Ibsen, a spokesperson for the Alaska Fire Service, said in an email that experienced wildfire managers have told her that the number of simultaneous evacuations is unprecedented. Right now, the Bear Creek fire near McGroarty's home is the state's first priority, says Sam Harrell, a spokesperson for the Alaska Division of Forestry. That's because of its proximity to the Parks Highway, which is the main artery connecting Fairbanks to the rest of the state.
It grew rapidly towards the north along the Parks Highway. There's a lot of thick black spruce stands in that area, and that area has had challenging wildland fires for the past several years.
Harrell says the fire jumped the Parks Highway and is burning on either side of the road. He says that sporadically, as smoke and fire conditions allow, pilot cars are leading groups of motorists through the fire area. Meanwhile, the Denali Borough is attempting to assess damage to homes and structures in the path of the fire. In Fairbanks, Borough Mayor Grier Hopkins says no structures have burned inside the borough so far, but there were some close calls over the weekend in the vicinity of the Himalaya Road fire, just northeast of town. The over 3,000-acre fire is the state's second firefighting priority.
There were 6 homes that were protected overnight by the state firefighters, you know, burned right up to the edge of the home and the property, but even though the firefighters couldn't see, you know, maybe 20, 30 feet, they were still able to protect those homes even down to the very last second by the tooth of the skin of their teeth.
Rick Toman, a climate specialist with the University of Alaska Fairbanks, says the dry fuel, hot weather, and abundant lightning all contributed to the fires. He points out that fires like this are nothing new in Alaska, but intense wildfire behavior should be expected more and more frequently as the climate changes.
We've seen much more fire in recent years, especially the frequency of those big seasons. And these explosive periods within the fire season.
As for the forecast ahead, Harrell, with the Forestry Division, says the rain will not bring much relief.
The rains that are in the forecast now for us with this cool weather is pleasant, but it's not going to be enough rain to end the current fire, wildland fire situation.
Harrell says several volunteer firefighters from Anchorage are on their way to help, as well as fire crews from the lower 48.
We have a jet load coming to Fairbanks with four hotshot crews on it. And those crews will be assigned to fires that are highest in priority based on defense of life and defense of property.
He says as the fire season ramps up in the lower 48, bringing up additional firefighters will become more challenging. With help from Elyona Niden and Chris Clint in Anchorage, I'm Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks.
The Alaska Department of Corrections is holding dozens of immigration detainees in an Anchorage jail and violating federal standards by denying them access to their attorneys and consulates and, in one incident, subjecting them to pepper spray. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
Immigration attorney Cindy Woods of the ACLU of Alaska has spoken to five of the men. She testified that the detainees have been held in lockdown for substantial periods since ICE transferred 41 men to Alaska on June 8.
Individuals are being held 2 to 3 in a cell with one open air toilet in a cell. In cells that are holding 3 people, one person must sleep on the floor, abutting a toilet that cannot be flushed on demand, but is flushed twice an hour.
Testimony at the hearing suggests that Alaska prisons, which are set up to isolate criminals from society, aren't easily remade into facilities that can relieve overcrowding as the Trump administration ramps up migrant arrests and deportations. The Anchorage Correctional Complex has a contract to house ICE detainees, but usually only takes in a few at a time before they are transferred out of state. This month, for the first time, ICE transferred men to Anchorage from a federal immigration facility in Tacoma. Democratic Representative Andrew Gray of Anchorage called the hearing. He repeatedly cited the ways he says the Department of Corrections is violating humane standards established during the first Trump administration for immigration detainees.
We Alaskans could be on the hook for financial damages if we are sued and lose. So it is our duty as a committee to understand why these people are here, what we are doing with them, and what financial liabilities we Alaskans may be responsible for.
Alaska Corrections Commissioner Jen Winkleman was the first witness. She said the detention was going well after a number of what she called bumps in the road. She said guards deployed pepper spray, not at anyone, but in the room to enforce a lockdown. Then Winkleman heard other accounts at the hearing that pepper spray had sent several detainees into respiratory distress, that they weren't allowed to change clothes for days, and that they were not allowed access to their belongings to retrieve phone numbers. In at least one instance, when an attorney did get through to his client, guards ended the call after 30 minutes. Winkleman told legislators several times that she was unaware of the specifics.
I will commit to this committee to look into that. This is the first I've heard of it.
Anchorage Democratic Representative Andy Josephson questioned why the state is agreeing to accept ICE detainees from out of state, especially since the federal government's reimbursement just covers the expense. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Orthodox pilgrims descend on Kuitluk to glorify Matushka Olga.
I'm finding the whole canonization very strange because she was an actual person to me that would hold me and piggyback me.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It doesn't matter what you were wearing, what you were drinking, or what you agreed to in the past. Sexual assault is never your fault. Support is available 24/7 through multiple resources. Visit notaloneak.org to find help for yourself or a loved one. Remember, it's not your fault. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Anchorage police say a man died yesterday and two people were wounded after a shooting in Spinard. Police said in a statement that officers found a man and a woman with upper body trauma at about 7:30 a.m. Sunday on West 32nd Avenue. They were taken to a hospital for treatment. About 90 minutes later, they also found a man who was declared dead at the scene. He hasn't yet been named by police. Police say detectives have spoken with everyone believed to be involved, and the incident presents, quote, no current public safety threat. A police spokesperson declined to release additional information today, saying only that the shooting remains under investigation. Meanwhile, the organization that helps oversee federal fisheries off Alaska's coast is scaling back operations due to uncertainty over federal funding. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council meets five times a year to help set fishing policies. That includes things like quotas, regulations, and bycatch restrictions. But federal budget cuts under President Donald Trump have whittled down the organization's resources, forcing them to scale back their activities. Executive Director David Witherell says they've only received about two-thirds of their annual funding. Usually, they have it all by March.
This is a highly unusual situation that we're in. We can normally be able to plan our meeting schedule for the year and not have to worry that, you know, the council offices might have to close because we run out of funds to pay staff.
Witherell says they're starting from zero with no rollover from the previous year. He says the council has been told to expect another installment once Congress finalizes a federal spending plan. But for now, there's no timeline and no guarantee.
The funding this year has been coming in dribs and drabs, and it's making it challenging to reserve meeting spaces and to know that we have the funds to host a meeting.
The council is dropping to only four meetings next year and will hold its next meeting in October online. In a statement, the council said they are also cutting back on travel and other expenses. They hope to hold an in-person meeting in December, but even that will depend on whether more funding comes through. Commercial fisheries rely on council recommendations in order to open. The council warns that its December schedule is overloaded with time-sensitive matters like chum salmon bycatch. For decades, residents in Nutok have been trying to move to safer high ground as climate change has dramatically altered the landscape. 46 brand new homes have been built for them in the new community, but 2 years ago, KYUK's Emily Schwing started to hear from residents that some of the new housing had problems. Since then, she returned several times to find out more.
In April 2023, I climbed a ladder up into the attic of a brand new house in Mahtavik.
There's water there, but I don't know where it came from.
That's photojournalist Seth Adams. He also knows a little bit about carpentry and construction. We were originally here to report on a $25 million grant from the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs. The money was meant to help complete Nutok's relocation to Mahtavik. While we were here, a few people told us the light fixtures in their brand new houses were filling with water.
So there is water in the ceiling.
I found water in between these bats.
How much water?
And the insulation. I mean, it's not trivial.
Up in the attic, we pulled up a few chunks of yellow fiberglass insulation. Adams suspected something might be amiss with the vapor barrier.
Ah! I knew it! They didn't seal it.
A vapor barrier is a continuous wrapping that's meant to keep moisture from building up in the walls. But if the seams between sheets of plastic aren't sealed, it won't work. Jack Charlie had only lived in this house for about 6 months when he noticed water damage in his walls.
It first started in the living room.
Charlie's old plywood home in Nutok was moldy and sinking into the tundra as the permafrost that supported the land thawed. So he was excited when he got to move into his new house in Mahtavik. Within months, his lights started to flicker. They were filled with water. He also noticed gaps starting to open up between the top of the wall and the ceiling.
But once I found out it was leaking and cold air drifting, I said, what kind of house they were building me?
Charlie stuffed toilet paper into the cracks to soak up the moisture and keep out the persistent coastal winds coming from the nearby Bering Sea. The money to build this house and a few others comes from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. When KYUK asked for inspection reports, the Nutok Village Council and federal agencies said they didn't have any. In the absence of an official inspection, we hired Emmett LaFell, an expert with more than 15 years of experience in cold climate housing design and energy ratings to come take a look.
And there, definitely, there's some thermal bridging there.
Early one morning last year, LaFell and I went for a walk through Mahtavik with a thermal imaging camera. It can spot heat loss from outside of a building.
Yeah, interesting. And then we're seeing more air leakage at the top of that wall near the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And above the kitchen.
This camera takes a special photo of a house, and as it pops up on the viewfinder, there are colors that range from bright yellow to dark purple. This is how LaFell determines where heat is escaping.
And you can start to see how that warm air is being pushed through that floor system, that wall floor joint.
Uh-huh. He has another way to measure the energy efficiency of a building, too. And that's with a blower door test. Back at Jack Charlie's house, LaFell fits a giant red panel with a fan into the doorway of a house. That fan sucks all the air out, and he can see where the leaks are.
We're getting air leakage on every wall, not just exterior walls, interior walls.
The first 14 families moved from Newtok into brand new homes in Mahtavik in 2019. Those homes were designed by the Fairbanks-based Cold Climate Housing Research Center. They were professionally inspected before residents moved in. Another 15 homes were designed and built by the Association of Village Council Presidents Regional Housing Authority. That organization says it has an internal inspection process. The third type of housing in Mahtavik was designed and built by Anchorage-based LeMay Engineering and Consulting. The tribe hired the company's founder and owner, Patrick LeMay, to do the work. At the time, LeMay was also working for the tribe as an employee. He did not respond to multiple requests for comment or specific questions about his housing design or its construction. But back in 2021, he gave an interview to KYUK.
And we're going to get these houses tested, and we're going to get them energy rated. I got a contract. I'm actually paying for that to be done since it's my design and it's my word that I have to prove.
LeMay said he could build a house with an energy rating that exceeded 5 stars for a fraction of the cost compared with the other two designs. At the time, he said he was taking a big risk.
And, of course, since it's my guy, he's actually going to look at my building design and actually look at my products and the houses going forward.
The Cold Climate Housing Research Center and AVCP's Regional Housing Authority designs received high marks from Emmett LaFell's formal inspections, although he did also make a few recommendations for repairs and upgrades. 4 of the 7 homes that LaFell looked over in Mahtavik were designed and built by LeMay. In his final report, LaFell expressed concerns about the foundations, writing that they do not meet minimum code requirements for corrosion resistance, adequate supports, or structural integrity requirements. 2 years of fuel usage data provided by the tribe shows residents in LeMay homes pay more than twice as much for energy each year compared to the other two housing projects. In short, LaFell says they don't qualify for the energy rating that Patrick LeMay promised.
The foundations were underbuilt and need to be replaced. That's major by itself. Beyond that, we look at the building envelope aspects of it. The vapor barrier system has to be completely redone on the ceiling and the walls. And so that requires a deep retrofit.
What you're talking about is like literally taking apart the house.
Yes.
And then putting it back together.
Yeah.
Emmett LaFell says it's likely that repairs and retrofits that the LeMay housing requires to keep them livable in the long term will cost more than the original construction. In Mahtavik, I'm Emily Schwing.
Emily Schwing is digging into Newtok's relocation in partnership with the Washington Post and ProPublica. This reporting was supported by the Alaska Center for Excellence in Journalism.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, providing telecommunication services to tribal health organizations and nonprofit rural health providers, enabling telehealth services for Alaskans. More at gci.com/healthcare. Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey.
UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member.
Three Anchorage Assembly members are proposing to criminalize camping on public land to address homelessness. Assemblymember Keith McCormick is one of the proposal sponsors. He says the city's approach isn't working.
We have to give the mayor the tools that she needs to address this. And I think it's disingenuous that we sit here and say the mayor's not addressing this enough, the mayor's not doing enough, and we don't give her the support that she needs legislatively to put into action real change.
Right now, it's against city code to camp in public spaces, but it's not a criminal offense. The city uses a process called abatement to clear out encampments. That usually takes 10 days and can result in some people going into shelter or housing, but many move to other public spaces and continue to camp. McCormick says the proposed ordinance would do away with the abatement system, making it possible for police to clear camps as soon as they start to pop up. Campers not willing to enter shelters or housing could be jailed. He says police would have discretion whether to arrest campers. But Anchorage Police Chief Sean Case says the proposal is so broad, it raises a lot of questions.
Does this mean when we're driving to a call for service that's considered a lower priority, that we stop every time we see a camp and now enforce this while we're en route to another call?
And he says the city doesn't have the resources to fully enforce the proposal as written.
Not only on the police department, but then everything down the line with prosecutors and courts and jail facilities as well. So just from an enforcement standpoint, we have to understand that we're going to be able to enforce this in a much more limited capacity than is written.
The public will have a chance to comment on the proposal at the Assembly's meeting tomorrow night. Two other versions of the proposal are also expected to be introduced then, one from the mayor's office that is more narrow, and one from the Assembly chair that includes taxation to fund resources he says are needed in the original proposal. Last week, the Western Alaska community of Kwikuk burst with activity as Orthodox pilgrims from across the world came to honor the first ever Yupik saint. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, the glorification of St. Olga brought together those drawn to her message of healing from afar and the people of the region for whom she's held a long saint-like status.
Shots ring out over the Kwikuk River as a mass of pilgrims lining the muddy banks sing a hymn of blessing on the eve of the summer solstice. At last, leaders of the Orthodox Church have arrived in Kwikuk for the glorification of Saint Olga, the first ever Yupik saint and the first female Orthodox saint in North America. For Kwikuk, the glorification is a long-awaited honor for Olinka Oksumkuk Michael or Matushka Olga, a local midwife who gained a reputation as a gifted healer of deep-seated trauma during her life. Since her death in 1979, accounts of her miracles have spread throughout the Orthodox world, culminating in this historic moment. In the crumbling cemetery of the old St. Nicholas Russian Orthodox Church, priests set St. Olga's wooden casket on blocks, just feet from the spot where they exhumed her remains 7 months earlier. As local priest Father Vasily Fisher explains, before St. Olga can be venerated as a saint, her final funeral rite, or panahida, must be performed. Going forward, the day of her death will be celebrated instead as her birth as a saint.
Everything is done as if going backwards. They come back to the church and in the presence of life. Our faith is about life. St. Jose is about life.
For thou art the resurrection and the life and the repose of thy servant Matushka Olga, who is fallen asleep, O Christ our God.
Some gathered in the cemetery have tears in their eyes. Others pat beads of sweat from their foreheads. Matushka Olga's descendants stand transfixed among headscarved pilgrims from nearby villages and from as far away as Romania and Australia. The head of the Orthodox Church in America, Metropolitan Tikhon, is here from Washington, D.C. As Archbishop Alexei of Alaska reads a passage from the Book of Psalms, A sudden gust of wind from nowhere cuts through the otherwise still afternoon. It's hard to not get swept up in the feeling that something miraculous is afoot.
Your soul shall dwell with the blessed.
After the funeral rite, a procession featuring flowing robes, golden banners, puffs of incense, and a couple curious village dogs bears the casket along a short dusty track to the church in the section of Cuitlic known as downtown. During the four-hour service that follows, it is standing room only, which works out well in a religious tradition that doesn't make use of pews. The chanting and choreography, what Archbishop Alexei refers to as an elaborate, beautiful dance, ends when St. Olga's casket is opened for pilgrims to kiss her sacred relics and receive her blessing. One of Matushka Olga's nieces, Bertha Howard, sums up her memories of her aunt succinctly. She helped, she was compassionate.
That's all I could say.
For Matushka Olga's granddaughter, Adun Winkleman, the inclusion of Yuktun in many of the glorification services is a highlight.
It's very cool to see actual Yuktun words, to recognize the Yupik people, to use the word elders in song. I've never heard that anywhere else in any of our venerating any other saint.
As pilgrims file by outside the church, Winkleman says the scene is a lot to process.
I'm finding the whole exhuming of her body, the whole glorification, canonization, very strange because she was an actual person to me that would hold me and piggyback me, and we would sit and eat together, or I would sit and watch her sew.
For many others, Matushka Olga has become Saint Olga, Matushka of all Alaska, a symbol of compassion, modesty, and empathy that appears to resonate just as much across the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta as it does the world. In Cuitlic, I'm Evan Erickson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks, Liz Ruskin, Chris Clint, Aliona Naidzin, and Hannah Floor in Anchorage, Theo Greenlee in Sandpoint, Emily Schwing in Machtovik, and Evan Erickson in Cuitlic. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training. ConocoPhillips Alaska, committed to Alaska for more than 50 years.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Got a broken voice and a twisted smile. Guess he's been that way now for quite a while. He's got blood on his shoes and mud on his brim. Did he do it to himself or was it done to him? Say that he don't look well. wash away all the paint from his purple hands before it gets too late. I saw him stand alone under a broken so sincere, singing silent night. But the trees, they were full and the grass was green. It was the sweetest thing I had ever seen. Yeah.
that he put in his 40 years, got his gold watch, and then they sent him home. I never knew what a struggle was like till I cried tears on a stone. He was just a cog in their wheel, lived and died on the layaway plan. The Lord hear the prayer of a common man. Hallelujah. Is anybody up there? Hallelujah. Does anybody care? Life takes its toll on the heart and soul, but I'm doing the best I can. The Lord hear the prayer of a common man. Braces, man, it cost a couple thousand bucks. She's got a beautiful smile, but it'll be a while on my new used pickup truck. This house of cards I built is mortgaged to the hilt, and it's sinking in the sand. Now, Lord, hear the prayer of a common man. Just need some clarity. I've got people counting on me, and I'm tired, that's all. I'm up against the wall. Lord, hear me when I call. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
I know you're up there. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
I know you care.
Never thought this would happen.
the first time since I hated you that I used to love you. And I don't know why I cry, but I think it's cause I remember for the first time since I hated you. She's upset, bad day. Heads for the dresser drawer to drive her pain away. Nothing good can come of this. She opens it, there's nothing there. It's only leftover tears. Mom and Dad have no right. She screams. Deal with all the pain, drenched sorrow and relief. Bite the lip, just forget the bleeding. And then she closed her eyes, found relief and a knife. The blood flows as she cries. Oh, oh. And then she closed.
Hop off a jet, barely get rest. Cash through the mud and I get a check. You selling run on my pants and my chest. Chanel address, clean up a mess. I eat her flesh, you know the rest. Pound up a hun, cop a Rolex. Shine like the sun, you truly blessed. Who's on the tape? In the club, but like I hoop with these jets. Yes, it's on me, got my Gucci shirt wet. Put an M in my bag, I'm getting used to these rats. I'm with this school where they teach you finesse. 500 shoes for the drip, I invest. I'm the boss, man, I keep catching the decks. Go to cool fast when they end with an S.
Now that I'm home, back off the road, we shut it down, where they sold. Checks on the streets, J number four, Saint Laurent feet, put it on toes. Take it with me, double your dose, covered with angels that's watching my soul. Jack out of bed, it's bigger windows. Said I beat the intent, but I got the info.
I feel like I'm chosen, I'm covered in gold. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm chosen, I'm covered in gold.
Kick the cup and now I'm asking